Hello there. I'm Charlie Ocean, and my pronouns are they, them. Welcome to Allyship is a Verb, a podcast for people practicing allyship for the LGBTQ plus community and beyond.
Hi, my name is Shane Wally, and my pronouns are Z here and here's.
Shane's episode was the inaugural episode of Allyship is a Verb. It's wild to think how much has changed since the first season, first episode. As I usually say, please go back and listen to the first one if you haven't already. However, I know some of you won't listen to me. Hi, you know who you are. Now, let's go to Austin, Texas and see what Shane's up to these days. But first, thank you, Claire! Claire, thank you so much for supporting the Indiegogo campaign and being a wonderful, supportive friend. I appreciate you so much. Here are three self-reflection questions to think about during the episode, and be sure to stick around after for three more. Number one, do I like being called brave or resilient? Why or why not? Number two, what keeps me motivated in life? What makes life worth living? Number three, am I my favorite version of myself? And here we go. Well, am I about to fangirl or something? What's happening? What is this feeling? You kicked off my podcast.
Yeah,
you were the first season, first episode, and I am so grateful for that because it ends up being one of the most listened to episodes because a lot of folks will go back and listen to that one to sort of like start the podcast in order. So, yeah, thank you.
Very honoring for me, too. So thank you. Yeah.
When you were first on the podcast, you had shared that you're genderqueer, queer, and elder, and white. This time, you've shared genderqueer, 62 years old and out since 1994, and white, and also that you're a social justice educative facilitator and storyteller. Is there anything you want to expand on about that?
I don't think so. I think it's always interesting when people ask you how you identify, right? Like I can use that language with you because I know what it means, right? If I was doing a podcast that was how to be a social worker, right, I might not use some of that language because people might not know what it means. I think, you know, if we're going to use kind of current terms, maybe I code switch a little bit around my gender identity.
There's macro and micro labels, let's lay them on the table. It may be time to enable the code switch. The code switch. Yeah, it depends on the switch. Sometimes you've got a code switch.
Right, like I identify as genderqueer, but a lot of people don't know what that is. So I also will identify as non-binary because more people know what that is, right? So I often will say that I identify as genderqueer, pause, non-binary. And I still strongly, and we talked about queer quite a bit in the first episode, right? I still strongly identify as queer. I do check in with myself. I think we also talked about kind of my check-in in the first episode around my pronouns. I think me trying to hold firm to what resonates with me and not taking care of others is still a journey for me, right? I'm learning to hold steady for what resonates with me and then maybe do a caveat to help give people context if they don't know.
Yeah.
One of the things that I've started talking a lot about is how we ask somebody what their language means, right? And the difference between asking me, Shane, please define genderqueer versus, hey, Shane, what does genderqueer mean to you? Right? One turns me into a dictionary and one allows me to tell a story about myself and give context for the language I use. And so I'm really a big fan of both being asked and asking others what language means to them. It's not that different in sentence structure, but it's a huge difference for me on how it lands.
Absolutely. That's something that I teach in my training sessions, because to your point, usually this is coming about when someone is inviting someone in and like are coming out, whatever language you want to use there. And so typically the drive for that is because we're seeking support. Like, I'm sharing with you that I'm non-binary, I'm agender, whatever it is, because I'm seeking support. And when then you ask someone like, oh yeah, you know, I don't know what that means, to your point, yeah, it puts us in educator mode when that's not the mode we're in. We're in I need support mode.
Right.
Then you're not even making someone reduce it to some dictionary definition, but also making them feel like they have to speak on behalf of an entire community, which no one can do. And then awkwardly stumbling through that perhaps, and maybe even still learning what it means to them. So yes, and in terms of what you've shared, I absolutely love the more personalized approach, because I think that's what people are meaning to ask anyway. Mm-hmm. And it also holds space for someone to share any intersectionality that may be important to them in that.
I also think, like, what does that mean also might put somebody on the defensive depending on how it's asked. Versus, again, that kind of joining or inviting in. I ask people what language means to them, even though I know the dictionary definition, right? Like, especially for people who identify strongly as queer, I'm always curious what it means to them. And there's usually an amazing story on how they got there, right? I'm interested in the context, not the definition.
And again, if this is under the context of that person coming out, I think it's also okay to ask them by way of support, do you want to talk more about that? Or do you want to share more about that? All of those are more supportive questions. Again, I think it's one of those situations where that's what people are meaning to ask, but they just don't know how to get there. I feel like it's really important that we try to get it right as much as possible and come from that place of love and curiosity. We can tell the difference. And maybe we can help redirect someone if we are in a space that we feel like we can do that. But yeah, shifting from supporter mode to educator mode is a really hard pivot, and it can hurt the relationship. So even asking something like, would it be okay if we talked more about that or something, right? You know, just to help bridge that gap and make sure that person's even in that place. Maybe they're too nervous.
Right. Yeah. I talk about respectful curiosity.
Yeah.
Right. And then respectful curiosity is always consent-based, right? You have space and time to answer some questions, because sometimes I have space and time and sometimes I don't.
With where you're at in your life now, when you share about who you are with someone for the first time because they're new to you, or let's say, hypothetically, you may end up adopting new language in the near future, how would you want that information to be celebrated? Or how would you want someone to celebrate you in that moment?
You know, I think that it's a great question, because I find that sometimes this celebration doesn't land well for me, right? It feels like it's too much. I get told a lot that I'm brave.
Ah!
Right? And yeah. I know that that is meant, right? It is meant with kind of love, but like, I am who I am and I don't have a choice about it. So I'm not being brave. I just am being. That is not my favorite thing. I think sometimes I just like people to be appreciative for me spending time and being vulnerable. You know, sometimes a well-placed thank you is great. I also then, depending on the context, but especially if I'm talking with friends, I appreciate if they are reciprocal and sharing something about themselves that's equally as vulnerable. Everybody has a set of identities and everybody has a story. I don't want to have to feel like I'm the only one who's being spotlighted, but that there's reciprocity in those conversations. Again, I think it's often really well-intentioned, to your point, but people want to kind of throw flowers in a way that I think, especially because I've been out for, I think this year it's going to be 30 years as genderqueer. Like, what? And 40 years as being queer. Like, I don't need to be congratulated for that. Although I will say that I appreciate the fact that I'm still here. And I think now when I teach, I often have young, right, like college age trans and non-binary folks in my class. I can tell, and sometimes they'll say it to me, of being grateful to know that someone 62 still lives and exists in the world. You know, I don't take that lightly. So that part, like the "you made it through" part, I don't mind a rose or two being thrown, but like the kind of congratulations for being who you are part, it doesn't always land well with me.
So I shouldn't send you the card that says, "Congrats, it's a Shane."
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
Well, there's a lot in what you just said. So going back to the piece about being brave, I kind of get where people are coming from, I think even more so than ever right now, just because of, even if you just follow the thread of the anti-trans and anti-LGBTQ plus legislation, in some ways it does feel brave.
Yeah.
There's also this conversation I've been having with my friends about the word resilient. And when someone says, "I'm so resilient," right? And you just made a face. So we'll get there.
It's like, yes, and, right? Yes, and.
It's bittersweet because it's like, yeah. I didn't ask for this. I didn't ask to have to be resilient because I don't think it's the flex people think it is. I don't think that we have to learn by way of trauma or hardship. We should be able to have access to good quality lives where, yeah, we're not like constantly under attack. And I don't even want to play the game of like who has it worse or anything, because I think everyone loses in that game. So I choose not to play it. But yeah, there's even something behind the resilient piece. And I guess like, when people are saying you're so brave, which again, I can see that because you have been doing this work longer than I have. Part of that is just because you're a little bit older than me. But, you know, I mean, when I think about different milestones that have happened in our community, like the Compton cafeteria riots, et cetera, you know, there's lots of examples out there. Like, really, I would say those people are brave. And there's also this like, quote out there, something to the effect of, you know, sometimes those people on the front lines, they have nothing left to lose, so they have to fight.
Right.
Thanks to Google, it might be never fight with a fighter who has nothing to lose. And there's variations of it. So another one is never contend with a man who has nothing to lose. If someone wanted to share something to the effect of, "Shane, you're so brave, you're so resilient," what would be a better way to receive that kind of love and support?
I appreciate it when people say, "I'm glad you're here." Like, I am here because of being resilient and being courageous and having, you know, support and community. So when people are just like, gratitude for my being, I take that in better because it doesn't make assumptions about why my being is here. It just acknowledges my being.
Well, Shane, I'm glad you're here.
Thank you. And you as well.
Thank you.
Yep.
Another thread I wanted to come back to. When we're sharing something vulnerable, you said that it would be well received for you to hear something in return, like have someone also share their story of who they are. Let's say that.
Yep.
Now, culturally, I've been taught by neurotypical people that it's rude to do something like that. However, we have learned over the years that there is a huge overlap between neurodivergence especially autism and ADHD, of which I check both of those boxes, and being part of LGBTQ plus communities. So not everyone receives that well. And so I think that, you know, points back to a larger issue of cultural stuff, because for the folks doing that, it's not meant to take away from Shane's experience. It's because I'm trying to relate to you. I'm not trying to like say I have it better or worse. It's just my way of saying, you just shared this deeply vulnerable thing with me, and I want to return the favor for genuine connection purposes.
Correct. Right. It's not about one-upping, like, oh, you think you had it bad. Like, it's not about that. I think it's about, so let's say I have a newish friend who invites me for a meal because they're wanting to find out more about non-binariness, right? So it's lunch and a lesson. Right? If in that, if you're asking me about my identities and you're not willing to share anything about yours, that doesn't feel good. So for me, it's about reciprocity. It's not necessarily about, oh, you did a 5 on the vulnerability scale, I can do a 6. It's not about that. It's about not feeling like a zoological creature, that I'm behind a fence and you are observing me, but that we are out in a prairie together, right? Like sharing experiences as creatures in the world. Does that make sense? It's probably not my greatest analogy, but it's kind of where white supremacy culture and whiteness means that we've been trained that we, the other, right? The person who is othered, it is their responsibility to let us know about them. And I think the reciprocity helps break that down.
What I hear in what you're saying, how it relates to me, is connection and community,
right?
Which can be really scary.
Yep.
And I found that in all the work I do, I feel like it's almost the answer to like everything.
Yeah. I mean, I talk about the fact that I think for our well-being, right, to be kind of our best selves, that we need hope, purpose, and community. That if we have those three things, right, as individuals, it for me increases wellness. Community is such an important part of that kind of three-legged stool.
Something I get from social media is definitely a sense of community and connection, and especially in the relationships that form from that. I'm even thinking of people who have been on the podcast, like Zoa and Maze. I wouldn't have met them if it weren't for Instagram, as an example.
Mm-hmm.
So something, a gem I recently got from social media, because, you know, I think there's a lot of really interesting posts. There's this sense of, I don't know, wanting to reframe certain things or rephrase certain things. And sometimes I'm down for that, or at least I'm open to it. One of the things I recently came across was not being interested in being my best self, but my favorite self. And so my question to you, Shane, is, are you your favorite version of yourself today?
January is a tough month for me, because January is the anniversary of my hospitalization. And anniversaries for me carry a lot of weight. I was in an inpatient, mental health inpatient setting in 2006. So it's been a very long time ago, for 2 weeks, and we're kind of in the middle of those 2 weeks. If part of my favorite self maybe is being a little contemplative inward, then yes, right? I mean, I appreciate the fact that my favorite self may not be, by other people's definition, somebody's best self. And so, right, which I think is your point. It's kind of like, you know, kind of reframing gender dysphoria to gender euphoria, how we think about things. You know, it's also the beginning of the year where everything you hear on the news is about fresh start. What are we going to do? How are we going to get better? And I'm kind of like, please be quiet. Like, there's shame and guilt in that for me. Or I feel like I need to get myself on an exercise program. I am a version maybe of my favorite self. You know, now I'm going to have to send you a check for therapy. So
Please give me a payment plan so that I have a better chance of paying it off. Yeah, I mean, for me, my favorite self, I think it helps us move away from capitalism and Western ideals and all that, because what is my best self? Like you said, is it this checklist that I'm reading in some magazine that wants me to feel shitty about myself so it can sling me more products? I don't know. Long ago, I've done away with like New Year's resolutions and all that. Because if I feel moved or agitated enough to like make a change in my life, I'm going to do it right away. I don't need some arbitrary new year or new month to be like, new year, new me. No, thank you. Not interested. But yeah, when I think about, am I my favorite version of myself? It's made me realize that yes, kind of like similar to your answer, there are parts of me that are my favorite version of myself. And it's also made me realize there are versions of myself in my childhood that I want to bring back, I guess, for a lack of better phrasing, right? Like I want to tap into Christina because she was awesome. And I've said this before on the podcast and I've been sharing this more openly later, well, as of late rather. And so like I couldn't be Charlie Ocean today if I wasn't Christina Angelina Murphy. Mm-hmm. And there are just things about her. You want to say resilience, you want to say that she was brave, whatever. There are pieces of her that I want to integrate into my favorite version of me presently. Thank you for sharing what you did about mental health. I think that especially when I'm thinking of like the 90s, and again, this is something that's come up on the podcast before, when I was first accessing media about the LGBTQ plus community, a lot of it was that the different members that you saw, like the different representation in media, there was always something like major mental health issues, there were murders, something died by suicide at the end of the movie. Like they could never have a happy story, right? And we've been seeing that shift. We've been seeing that shift in a lot of different shows and movies. And it's not to say that we don't experience mental health concerns. It's more that like it's not inherently because we're part of the LGBTQ plus communities. It's more that it's a reflection of society and how much acceptance we have or not, or what kind of, you know, things are happening legislatively. And I know it's a little bit more complex than that, but for me, it's a lot more social than anything else. It brings me back to that example of when a plant isn't doing well, you change the environment, not the plant, right? So like if I'm in an environment that sets me up for better success, which again, capitalism, et cetera, doesn't allow for that, at least not for everyone, that makes a huge difference. So I guess that said, with this, I think you said it's Mental Health Awareness Month for January?
It is January's Mental Health Awareness Month,
What do you feel moved to share about your experience outside of what you've just told us?
What got me there, right, was feeling like I was my favorite self, like I'd found this amazing thing out about myself. So I came out right around the gender identity piece in the mid-90s. I think I said 2006, and I should have said 1996. I don't know what year I said, but 1996 would be the year. So I had language for myself. I was wearing clothes I wanted. I felt really strong until I talked to my parents on the phone, and they were not on board. And I was seeing, fortunately, an amazing therapist at the time. I just didn't want to have the fight all the time. And again, right, like 1994 was a time where I identified as living in the gender gray. We didn't have language. There was no community. I didn't have role models. I didn't want to be on the planet. And the way that I kind of navigated the world was I was kept exceedingly busy. I worked a job that was more than 40 hours a week. I was on about 5 committees. I was working at Cornell University. And if I stopped to be with my thoughts, it was bad. So I just kept on track. And I realized that in order to get where I needed to go, I needed to be able to put my life on hold for a bit. And 1 hour a week in therapy didn't allow the deep dive that needed to happen. And amazingly, my therapist, so one of the things I was dealing with was always feeling like I was an outsider and never feeling like I belonged. And my therapist wanted to make sure that I didn't reproduce that in an inpatient program. Right? So she interestingly found an LGBT unit in a private hospital in Tampa, Florida, that had there at the time there was a gender center, like a surgery center, right, for gender affirming surgeries in Tampa. And this hospital had a therapist who had worked with trans clients, and that was not very common at that time. That's where I went, and I was able to do what I needed to do there. And I'm not sure that I would be on the planet had I not done that. And it was terrible and scary and frightening. And I think a lot of times for me, it's easier for me to come out as queer and genderqueer than as somebody that has a pretty serious history around mental health challenges and has inpatient as kind of part of my resume of that. I think it's important for who I am in the world and how visible and outspoken and vocal I am and how brave and resilient and all those things, right? Is that I wouldn't be those things if I hadn't had that experience in 96. I talk about it. I talk about it with people because we're often taught that we have to kind of pull ourselves up by our proverbial bootstraps, right? And muscle our way through. And going back to kind of community care and support. And I was fortunate that I had good private insurance and had a supportive partner who was financially better off than I was and could, you know, help me, because good mental health care is not accessible for everybody, for many, actually. So,
yeah. Something interesting that came up for me is I've been suicidal since second grade.
Yeah.
There's a whole story there. Mm-hmm. By the time I graduated from my social work program, since we're both social workers,
yeah,
it was 2014. I first worked at a place called Teen Line. Both at Teen Line and shortly after, when I'd work at the Trevor Project, both of it was primarily suicide prevention. Mm-hmm. Both also had a focus on the LGBTQ plus communities. I thought at that point, because I was in my first apartment by myself, I felt like, oh, I'm doing this adulting thing. It wasn't long after that I realized that none of us know what we're doing. We're all just trying to figure it out and make it look like we know what we're doing. But yeah, trying to hide that, I think, because of things like shame. However, I thought, oh, okay, I'm good now. Yeah, I've got this like first job out of school. I mean, I'd been working, you know, well before that, but you know, I've got my first social work job. You know, all these things are coming together. And then especially once I was working at the Trevor Project, I was like, you know, this is such an amazing organization. They're doing such great work. I always thought like, okay, that voice can be silenced now. And I've had to make peace, and you're shaking your head. I've had to make peace with the fact that I'm always going to be suicidal. Now, the levels to which that is loud or present in my mind varies. Mm-hmm. And I'd say the biggest piece that drives that is my lack of community and support.
Mm-hmm.
So when there are periods of time that I don't feel like I have as easy of access to community and support, that gets much louder.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes even when I do have community, but again, the support piece is still missing. And by support, I mean, in this particular case, things like financial means, like you were talking about having access to good healthcare,
right,
having access to good, informed, culturally competent, cultural humility, you know, based,
right,
therapists, et
cetera. Right.
And it's just been something that's been difficult for me to have consistently. And I've also just hit a point where like, I'm just done with talk therapy. I'm all talked out. I don't need to talk anymore. Well, I can rant. I can rant for days. I think people know that if they know me at all, but it doesn't penetrate deep enough into like the stored body trauma. So I can talk therapy all day, but it's not going to help me a lot in the way of progress. But that said, I'm always going to be suicidal. The degree to which that is loud or present is going to shift and vary over time. I'd like to just squish it once and for all, so it's not even an option, but it is.
Yep.
I'm curious, like when you were shaking your head earlier, like if you feel comfortable sharing, like how do you relate to that?
Got a couple of decades on you. And it's still present for me. I have a couple of people in my life that I can be honest with about it and not worry that I'm going to end up, you know, without my consent, right, in an inpatient hospital. That becomes a reason why people don't talk about it. It's scary to be honest and then lose control of what is going to happen to you. There are times when I think, again, as somebody who is 62 and trying to figure out what I'm going to do with the rest of my life, right? I'm situated in Austin, Texas. Even though Texas doesn't feel safe, it is home and it is community, right? Like I have built a world here, you know, again, going back to that kind of hope, community, and purpose, right? If I leave Austin, I lose community, possibly purpose, and then hope goes, right? So I have to be careful to stay in the present, or it makes, right, it makes things worse for me. So yes, I think for me, I might use the term suicidal ideation is always with me, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I maybe not going back as far as you, but definitely starting very strongly in high school, you know, until now. It's a long journey. It can be scary.
Yeah. Have you lost anyone in your community because they've left Texas?
I have a lot of trans friends, adults, right? Not kids, but adults who have left and are living in more progressive states. Good for them, and I'm happy for them. And I know families who have trans kids who have left the state. I mean, I think, you know, going back to the mental health piece, it is hard to live in a place where every day when you turn on your TV or your radio or you look online, you're hearing hateful untruths, right? Like all the time. You know, we're a very big anti-reproductive justice state. So this legislative session took a toll in one way. And then in the other way, right? Like the community showed up and was at the Capitol almost every day. And so there was a lot of community built around the people that were showing up. But I would much rather we got to show up for different, gather for happier reasons than, you know, than the fight. So I've been trying to have conversations. I've been wanting to have, maybe hungry to have conversations that I call dreaming forward. I am tired of being reactive, and I would like to live in a world where we're proactive. And so for me, you know, I've been doing miracle questions with groups of people, including my students, saying, you know, if we woke up tomorrow and trans and non-binary people felt a strong sense of belonging, what are some of the first things that we would notice are different? And then how do we plan to work forward to that reality, which for me is a much more hopeful frame? And the truth is, especially in states that are after us, like the thought of being proactive is difficult because the reality is we're having to, you know, kind of play defense. But I think we can do this work differently. And I am a dreamer, right? And so the other piece that I have been talking a lot about recently is when I say belonging, I don't think people can truly belong unless equity is in place. So I talk about belonging as a way to talk about equity without using the term, because everything needs to be in place so I can be in a space and relax and feel like I can bring my full self in. And in order to be able to do that, the equity piece has to be there. So part of this work is figuring out what the frames are that aren't always thinking about it from a deficit model that might open some doors differently.
And to your point, a lot of people talk about being inclusive and the belonging piece. You can create a space that's inclusive, but it doesn't mean people are going to feel like they belong.
Correct. Yep. Yeah, I can be included and not at all feel like I belong.
So, hot take I have, I think, since we talked about this a long time ago, LGBTQ+ or LGBTQIA+, which do you use currently right now and why?
I use LGBTQIA+ currently.
I know you don't like the plus.
It's a necessary evil, maybe. Right? Like, I understand it. And as somebody who started out with, when it was just a G and maybe an L if you were lucky, right? It's where I started in the alphabet. And I do it because it brings in as many letters as I think people can tolerate. I include the I because I think intersex gets left out of the conversation a lot, and I think it needs to not.
Yeah.
I am so interested in how A has changed over time. Like back in the day, A was ally, and now I know groups of people who don't feel it should ever be used as ally, right? And we use it as agender, asexual, all the A's.
Yeah.
A was for ally. Now we question why you don't belong here. It's what we used to say, but now we don't do it that way, cause you are not queer. A was for ally, but now we say goodbye, you don't belong here. It's what we used to say, but now we don't do it that way, cause you are not queer. Now it's ace, agender.
I hope people remember.
What about aromantic? I think they're fantastic.
I'm gonna quickly clarify here that I appreciate those practicing allyship. And sometimes when you're trying to write a catchy song, you can't do that with nuance. And so please understand that when I'm saying you don't belong here, it simply means that ally should not be part of LGBTQIA+, because it's not a queer identity. So that's all I'm trying to say.
And so it's been interesting for me because I've had, you know, when people are like, well, what's the A? I have to kind of stop and be like, well, and again, we talked about this a lot with the first podcast. Like I may say, well, the historical context is, right, A was for ally, and now complicate it, right, and go forward.
Well, and I recently had someone ask me, what does the plus stand for? I had to pause and I had to really think about it. And I was like going through the letters. I was like, okay, what's missing from here? And then, you know, I landed, you know, depending on how you use the B for bisexual,
yeah.
If you're using that to be encompassing in an umbrella term of things like pansexual, omnisexual, yeah, et cetera, you know, then cool, we're covered. But when I had to think about what the plus included, I forget what I even said in the moment to my friend, but I was glad that they asked me that because I was like, yeah, shit, we say it all the time, but I've never seen anyone explicitly say what the plus is including.
I think I say the plus stands for all of the language that has been developed and will be developed that has not yet made it in the alphabet, right? Because demisexual, we don't have a D in there.
Similarly with the bisexual community, demisexual falls under the asexuality umbrella, so technically it could fall under the A. It just depends on where people see themselves and where they want to be within the communities.
Right. There's just so much language. Part of my resistance, too, is who and how do we decide when a thing, you know, gets added? And I know people who use longer alphabets than that. You know, I sometimes find myself like bristling or getting resistance. So,
and that's my hot take. I've been wanting to venture out and use LGBTQIA+ because I know that in the past when I've said it, people who are agender, asexual, aromantic, etc., intersex, they really appreciated that because they see it so little.
Yep.
So my hot take, though, is then when it becomes nearly the whole alphabet, I think it takes away, and I think it also becomes a issue for those who are disabled, because I think it becomes inaccessible for people to say. I already know people who stumble on it anyway with just like LGBTQ.
Right.
What I'm getting at is that people have different access needs. Even people from within the community also stumble on the various initialisms. Now, acronyms inherently are easier to pronounce because they're meant to be read as a word, which is why I spent a great amount of time coming up with a new acronym that I really liked. However, when I started talking with friends about it, and I even told Shane about it, there were some holes that people were finding. Number one, it didn't inherently scream queer like previous ones have. Number two, it also includes people who are cisgender and straight, which I actually think is a good thing. But some of my friends were not convinced. But also, it's just hard to propose something new and hope that people understand the thinking behind it is that this is a bigger picture acronym versus doing all of the infighting of figuring out which letter goes where and when. And yeah, Hot Mess Express. Also, we can't exactly get away from initialisms because sometimes we still need them when we're only talking about specific communities, especially in something like research. I don't have the answers, but I did want to give it a try, and maybe someday I'll more formally tell people about it, but for now, I'm going to go back to the drawing board. And you may be thinking, Charlie, what about queer? Doesn't that just seem like the solve-all? Like, everyone knows that term, don't a lot of people align with it? And the answer is no. There's a significant chunk of folks that don't align with that term. And so I think because of things like geographical location and different cultures and societies, everyone's going to have to choose the language that best represents them, including the larger groupings of people. So whether that's LGBTQIA+, queer, 2S, LGBTQIA+, whatever that looks like. They are individual and community-based decisions. And I don't know if we'll ever have like a good universal answer to that. I don't think it's possible because of intersectionality and geographical differences, etc.
Well, and the fact that we have expanding language, right? We have expansive language, which people want to use the language that most brings them joy, right? Or fits with them. And when I used to teach Peers for Pride, we would come up with as much of the language as we could at that time. And again, that was a decade ago now, right? Like I went all the way across a whiteboard in a classroom. And I think it's tricky to say, like I get it from an ableism lens, but I remember when people couldn't say LGBT, like they couldn't get four letters out of their mouth, right? And then we put a Q, right? Yeah, and so I've become really accustomed to LGBTQIA+. But yeah, I don't know that there's a right answer, right? For a while, people were using quilt bag for a hot minute, right? Like, fortunately, that went away. Yeah, I don't know. We'll see. Because when people say, well, why do we even need labels, right? I'm like, we need labels so we can oppress people. That's why, right? I think a lot of times that's why the labels are there, right? Like homosexual was coined so we could be studied.
Well, I mean, for me, like it's been, and this isn't everyone's experience. However, for myself, I know it's been critical because it's helped me define community and language to describe my experience. And I know that that will continue to evolve. So to me, those like far outweigh the cons.
So I think as long as we can help an audience understand why we use what we use, you know, again, if you're asked what the plus is, do you have an answer for that? If you leave out something, you can explain, you know, why you leave it out. You know, one of the things in the work, right? We talk about the work, like we know what that means, but in social justice or DEI work or is, you know, being able to sit in the discomfort when people disagree with you about your alphabet and that you can stay in and have those conversations. I have a hard time with historically, what's the term you use? Historically what?
Historically excluded groups.
But we're also currently excluded groups. And so when we only say historical, then people can think it happened in the past and it's been fixed. So I often will talk about, I may say historically and currently excluded groups. And again, that's just my thing, right? Because we often talk about in higher ed, we talk about historically marginalized groups. I'm like, currently marginalized groups.
Right.
So every time you've said it, right, like I bounce a bit. And I'm like, we're going to have a chance to talk about that. You know, can we stay in conversations with each other? And the answer I know with you is yes, or you wouldn't be doing a podcast. Mm-hmm. That's right. Like this wouldn't be a format you set up if you weren't willing to have a conversation. So
I know I could change it or have a subset of like Charlie is wrong and then just have conversations with people where they help me get to the better language. And
I don't think it's wrong.
Yeah.
This is.
We're always doing the best we can with the information we have, which is why like now you'll see this shift to more folks saying people of the global majority meant to like replace people of color. I get why. And we don't want to use that as a catch-all all the time, because sometimes we're not talking about all people of the global majority. So if we're only talking about people who are Samoan, then we need to say that.
Right.
And we need to be as specific as possible. And I think that's what you were talking back to the whole piece around like which initialism or acronym. Sometimes it's going to matter, because if you're doing a study academically, right, someone obtaining their PhD or has their PhD, whatever, they're doing this research, then if they say LGBTQ+, but they're really only talking about LGB,
yep,
I'm going to pause, because that's not accurate.
Correct.
I think it's being intentional and being ready to answer, can you help me understand why you use this, right? And I think most of the time in those documents, they tend to say, this is why we use this language, whatever, which is good and should be the thing. But what is a term that is new to you that you've learned recently?
I think I have been talking to people, giving them knowledge, and haven't recently maybe been in spaces where I'm learning. So I feel like I learned one in class from a student, but I can't remember. I don't have an answer for that.
Mine is going to take me hopefully a quick second to look up. So Cody, who has been on the podcast and known as Ace Dad Advice, has these really wonderful educational posts. Sometimes will drop a term I haven't heard of before, and I'm like, what? The most recent term I've learned as of about 6 days ago is wavership. Wavership describes a relationship that fluctuates between different relationship types while remaining one relationship. For example, one day it can be a romantic relationship. Other days it can be queer platonic, and other days it can be platonic. So waverships are a way to describe relationships for folks who have fluctuating experiences of romantic and other kinds of attractions. And I actually really loved that. Without airing your personal life, I think that you and I have had conversations about certain relationships in our lives that I think that actually would fit.
Yes. I was going to say, oh, I have a friend I'm going to have.
So yeah, and I love it. I think it's actually kind of cute.
Yeah.
So Shane, in your inaugural episode, you claim to be politically sassy. Is that still your vibe? And if so, break it down for us. What's the essence of being politically sassy, and what role does that play in your world?
Yeah, I would say that is probably still true. It's code, right, for fierceness. Fierceness scares people. Sassiness is inviting. And I think for me, it is about speaking my truth in spaces where it might be illegal, you know, and holding space for other people to be able to speak their truths as well. And trying to break out of the white supremacy culture characteristics, right? Like, I now start every class by putting up a slide that has four different images, and there are four different images every day, having my students check in with each other to find out what picture they're vibing with. And the pictures usually have different types of emotional, right, components. And then, you know, I give each number and I ask them to raise their hand on where they are. And then I ask them what the vibe is. And I find that what they think the vibe is and why I may have chosen the picture are not, right, the same. And that probably takes 5 to 7 minutes of my class time.
I don't know. I love that.
Right. But like, for me, relationship before task, right, is imperative. And so for me, that, you know, breaking the academic rules, right, is part of my political sassiness. I also now do that in all of my workshops. And it's super helpful for me because one of my pictures has the Tasmanian devil, Eeyore, Timon, kind of in a outstretched like, and an angry bird. If I have a bunch of people who all are feeling like Eeyore, I know I have to like step up my peppiness. Or if I have a bunch of angry birds, we're going to just talk about that before I start, right? So it also helps me kind of get a feel of what, you know, what the status of the thing is.
I love that, because earlier when you talked about being present and working on being present, I think that's a beautiful way to ground in the session and be together, because it's really easy to whip out our phones, scroll through Instagram and pretend like we're half listening, but we're really not and all that. And I think being able to take a moment and ask ourselves, yeah, how am I feeling right now? And being able to see, especially if like there are people that resonate with that too, then yeah, it creates that sense of community. All right. Quick one for you, Shane. Complete the following sentence. You can be blank and blank.
You can be kind and fierce. People, you know, that we've had this kind of gone through this place of like social justice warriors. And there's a feeling of that. That's a person who's angry all the time, right? And that you can't say anything without getting corrected, right? Like there's a whole backstory that goes with somebody who is seen as a social justice warrior. I may or may not have been called that, right? I'm also somebody who, you know, I can be politically outspoken and I can be highly relational and interpersonal and kind. I can hold that duality every day. All the time. I don't think people understand that.
Again, on the internet, I've seen things about like, I don't care about niceness. It's completely different from kindness, you know, which is more intentional. And when I hear fierceness, I hear boundaries. Mm-hmm. So I can be kind and have boundaries is what I was taking away from what you just shared.
That's also true. Yeah.
Shane, you dropped wisdom last time about acknowledging, apologizing, and repairing when we mess up.
Yeah.
Anything new on that front?
Do not jump in to save a person without finding out if it's what they want to have happen. Right? And here's the example. So I'll tell a story, right? I was having brunch with a good friend of mine who I have permission to share the story from. You know, my gender is often read in the context of who I'm with. So if I'm with a cis woman, right, I get ladied. And so we had been late, you know, ladies, what do you want? Ladies, do you want more water? Ladies, ladies, ladies. And I had heard it every time. And my friend, maybe the fourth time, our server left, walked away. And my friend asked, she's like, she just ladied us. And I'm like, yes, fifth time. She's like, oh, I just heard it. She's like, would you like me to pull her aside and have a conversation with her? And I said, I so appreciate that you're interested in doing that. And no, thank you. And she said, which I appreciated, she said, do you have space to tell me why you don't want me to do it? So she didn't just insist that I tell her, she checked. And I said, you know, for me, with people who are one-offs in my life, I don't think they need to know all the things. She's our server and she's hustling. It isn't important to me that you do that. And I've had another friend since then. Also, we had the same situation, same conversation. Instead of her leaping in and being like, server, how dare you? The person I'm meeting with is non-binary, right? Like, which would have been terrible for me,
yeah.
Right? Like it impacts my safety. It impacts possibly the quality of the food I'm going to eat. So always making sure that you're checking in. If you think that an intervention needs to happen, you know, people, I have this conversation about pronouns too. They're like, well, if somebody gets misgendered, what should I do? And I said, check with your friend and find out what they want you to do. Don't assume that they want you to make a big deal about it or correct it, because it often centers us in a way that makes us unsafe. So always check in, get permission. If you can think to do it in advance, that's delightful. To do it in real time is super helpful.
I had created a few years ago a pronoun and name mistake flow chart for like what to do.
Yeah.
I'd recently made some updates to it, but the very intentional thing I included, especially the first round, was the consent piece. Like, do you have consent to correct on someone else's behalf? And I don't mean the person who made the mistake. I mean the person who it impacts, the person who has been misgendered or the wrong name was used.
Right.
And then I'll explain, ideally, when you're meeting someone and first getting to know them and all that, trying to ask them around that time can be really helpful before anything happens, just so you can be super clear.
Right.
And heck, I'd even check in over time just to see if that's like changed at all.
Right.
The other piece of it is that, okay, if it's happening during a meeting, what you could do is, you know, especially depending on your relationship to that person, how close you are, you know, there's lots of dynamics to consider, but you can ask them after the fact, like, by the way, I overheard, you know, and I noticed you didn't correct them. Would you like me to do that in the future? So there's always a way to come back to it, including if you've made the mistake yourself and you didn't self-correct, no one else gently nudged you about it. And this is said a lot. I think we've said a lot of cliches throughout this episode. We're not a monolith. Not all of us are honored in the same ways. Some of us, yeah, want a more, like, I don't know, quieter existence, if you will, because, yeah, don't need to cause a scene. And like you said, if I'm probably never going to see this person again, I don't care for them to know that much about me. If there's going to continue to be a relationship, maybe I am a regular at that establishment or something, then maybe I might say something like, oh, by the way, I'm non-binary. But usually it's after they've served me a few times. It's usually not like the first one because I have to work up the nerve to do it. But
right. Yeah, I was at a tire shop, which would actually probably be the least likely place that I might correct somebody. But the guy who was working with me was super friendly and was obviously trying hard to get my business. And so I said to him as I was paying my bill, I said, can I give you a customer service tip? And he was like, yes. And I said, I'm non-binary, so sir and ma'aming me is not particularly helpful. He said, what would have been? I said, just to call me Shane, just use my name. And he was like, great, thank you. Right? Like, he was so grateful. But I had established a bit of a relationship and with rapport with him over the time that they were fixing a leaky tire and he was the manager. So I also figured he might then train his other employees. Like, it felt like a bigger tell than just to him. Or maybe he might call me back and ask me to do it. Training, right? Like, it felt like there were a lot of reasons to possibly have that conversation. But I think allies often want to help, right? But it's really best to find out how people want help.
And that's the thing. Sometimes it's coming from corporate or something, right? Like, that's exactly how they've been trained, is to sir or ma'am people, or say Mr. Ocean or whatever. And especially when I'm like on a healthcare call, because I know we're probably going to be like a health insurance call, and I know we're probably going to be on there a while, I always interject immediately and just say, you know, please call me Charlie.
Yep.
Because that's it. And they'll sometimes like fall back into it and say, I'm sorry, Charlie. I'm like, it's cool. Thank you.
Right.
And it doesn't have to be like the why or anything, but yeah, like, I just don't need the formality.
Right. Yep.
So.
Yeah.
Shane, thanks for coming back. It's always a pleasure to connect with you. And thanks again for helping to kick off the podcast's first season. Speaking of, if you would like to help, we're up for 2 nominations right now. The Rainbow Mic and People's Choice Award by Sonic Bloom Awards. You can vote for the People's Choice Award as many times as you'd like through January 25th when they announce the winners in Orlando, Florida. I'm not asking you to vote a bajillion times. However, any votes would be incredibly appreciated if you've gotten anything from this podcast and the guests. And now, the final 3 self-reflection questions. Number 4. Do I experience suicide ideation? If so, do I know who and where to go for support? Number 5. Do I feel like I belong? Number 6. Have I ever heard of the term waivership? Does it apply to any of my relationships? Visit allyshipisaverb.com for any resources and a full transcript of the episode. And remember, sometimes allyship means voting for your favorite podcasts.